guys. This is another episode of Vertical Momentum. My name is Richard Kaufman, your host, also known as the Comeback Coach. Guys, this episode is going to be different than anything you've ever heard on my show before. This is going to be emotional. It's been very emotional for me the last 48 hours. This is the first episode I've ever had where I couldn't sleep the night before. And so I just want to introduce my friend Brendan. We've known each other, I'm guessing, since at least 99, 2000, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And he's been a brother to me. He knew me when I was a shitbag. You know, when I just got busted from E4 to E1. And they were about to throw me out. And then he knew me when I got promoted to E5 and won Soldier of the Year. So he knew the whole gamut. And he also knows that when we got deployed in 2003, my own company, Charlie Company, Cobras, they didn't want me. So they sent me to Bravo Company because they knew I was such a piece of shit. They thought I was going to get that. And that has really stuck with me over the last 20 years. So, I don't know where this is going to go, and it's okay. I'm all right with that, you know, because it's just two brothers catching up and talking about, you know, keeping it real, you know, and the stuff. So how are you doing, my brother?
I am doing outstanding. I am so glad to be here and truly honored that you would even consider having me on as a guest.
Oh, please. You know me. I'm just... And I'm a sucker for old friendship. And I'm still trying to find that DVD. I'm still looking for where you videotaped me ironing clothes.
Oh, are you kidding? Let me tell you something, my friend. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I happen to have a box full of A.T. the Movie 2006 available now.
Oh, I got to get a copy.
It's on the way. It is on the way. I mean it's the least I could do. You probably are one of the biggest stars to come out of it. You had several intensive scenes in there, really carried the movie.
And you know, and I think back, you know, like one of the guys that, even though I knew I was a shitbag when I was, you know, I kept getting busted. Sergeant Shepard always took me under his wing and taught me how to be an NCO. And now I'm, you know, people that we were together with are gone, you know, like Shep and, Alvin, you know, and I think of
Studley.
Yeah. You know, and I keep thinking about that and I'm like, wow, you know, how important short life really is. So like I said, guys, I don't know where this conversation go, but it's going to be all over the gamut, and that's okay because it's my show.
That's right.
To do. So, you know, so tell us a little bit, you know, about you. Where are you from? Where were you born and raised, and what kind of little boy was Brendan?
Oh, geez. That's a...
I told you we're going to get in the Wayback Machine.
Well, let's unpack that one. So I was born... Portland, Maine, and my parents divorced when I was about 8, and when I was 12, my mother moved us, my brother and I, to Rockingham, North Carolina. So very interesting, a lot of things just in that in general. You know, in Maine, as you can imagine, there's very different school curriculum and a little bit better funded. And I was considered an average student, maybe. I showed up in Rockingham and I was instantly on the academically gifted list. So I knew something was up.
Are we talking to the same guy?
Yeah, exactly, right?
Is that your brother?
Well, and you know, similar story there too. And, but the funniest thing was, you know, more than anything in school as a 12-year-old, it was the language barrier, speaking, Maine, going from Maine to, Rockingham, North Carolina, home of the Rock, Winston Cup favorite. You know, there's a different lingo.
NASCAR Heat 5 last night, so.
Exactly. You know, and I, so, you know, I came down saying things like oil and you all and crayfish. And I had to learn them all, y'all, and crawdads. so, but ultimately, you know, I think all around I was a good kid. Being initially raised in Maine, there's nothing to do but go in the woods, and not a lot of trouble to get into as a youngster. And, you know, when I came to North Carolina, I missed Maine. I missed my friends and I missed the woods. So I joined the Boy Scouts, and I was that guy.
Now, what kind of high school student were you?
Honestly, by the time I got to high school, I realized that I had already spent enough time in Rockingham, and I had to do whatever it took to get out of there. Because at the time, I mean, not to hate, but, you know, the major employment opportunities were the Purdue plant, or, you know, whenever the cup race would roll into town. In between that, there's not a whole lot else to do there. And I knew I was grasping at any straw I could get to get out. So I studied very hard. I had straight A's. I had a weighted 4.6 GPA coming into my junior year. I was very active. That being said, my junior year, I got early acceptance to the Citadel, and I also enlisted in the National Guard, North Carolina.
All right. So hold on. Let's hop on, you know, 'cause I love everybody's recruiting story. So talk to me about the day you walked into the National Guard recruiting office, and you know, you had such, if you were scoring that high and you had such a high GT, tell us about that.
Well, that was very interesting, because at that point in my life, the only job for me at all was a Navy Top Gun pilot. That's what I was going to do. Second choice, you know, I was going to go Air Force and be an A-10 pilot. The Army was not even on my radar at that time. However, you know, it was the Clinton years, and there were, no one's getting waivers during that time, and I'm blind. And so the Navy sent me crying, and then the Air Force said, take a walk. And luckily, you know, my local National Guard recruiter was there to put his arm around me and say, hey, buddy, you know, I got something for you. Let me tell you about the combat engineers.
But then when you took the ASVAB, you must have blew it away, right?
I did. I was, you know, mid 90s. I could have done anything, basically. But for me, you know, I'd also grown up in a military household, and I'd seen all the movies. And, you know, if I was going to be on the ground, I was going to be a grunt. That was my outlook at the time. I was not the most, I was very intelligent. I wasn't very bright.
You know, and I get that, you know, like, there's a lot of people that are book smart, but don't have any street smart. And then there's certain people that have book smart and street smart, and those are the lethal ones. You know, those are the,
exactly,
those are the guys that you want in your foxhole, you know?
Exactly. And I learned quickly, you know, that I had to pick up the street smarts. And the Army is great for teaching you that.
So you joined the North Carolina National Guard. So how the hell did you end up in South Carolina? And and of all places, Conway. Now, I love Conway because now my boy is actually going to Coastal Carolina. He's a Coastal Carolina student. So I've always loved Conway. I always consider it my home. And when they closed the armory, it kind of just crushed my heart. So how did you get involved in the Conway National Guard?
So I enlisted. I signed my papers, went to MEPS, and I was off to Fort Leonard Wood to become a combat engineer. And then at the last minute, well, they didn't have any slots at engineer school. So if I wanted to keep my bonus, I could choose tanks. And that was it. Basically, they're like, you know, just go to Knox and you'll do your 8 weeks. And when you come back, we'll send you to engineer school. And you know, basics, basic, whatever. They didn't mention the whole OSIT thing. Or 16 straight weeks of basic.
are you telling me that a recruiter left something out?
Well, you know, geez, guy. I think, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. He had a quota. Okay. And so I said, fine, give me my bonus. And I went to Knox. And after you finally get around to the FTX phase and you finally fire that main gun for the first time, there was no way I was going back to being an engineer. Like that, I was a tanker. I got my boots. That's it. I'm MOSQ'd. And so I actually, was placed in a tank unit based in Southern Pines. Our tanks were at Fort Bragg. And, as I mentioned, I also applied to the Citadel and I was accepted. So when you're at the Citadel, the only job you're allowed to have is the National Guard. So I transferred, to the only tank unit that was available at the time. And well, actually I was originally transferred to Myrtle Beach. But by the time, my freshman year was over, they had already moved to Conway.
You know, I think that's where we first met, was in, Myrtle Beach, you know, with Art Satley, and the funny thing is, I was trying to think the first time I met you, and I think we were going to grab something for lunch, and I got in your beat up car that you had that was full of clothes, and you had this awful music on, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? Am I going to make it? Is he going to kill me? And that was the first time I ever met you, and we were like Pizzos from that minute on. We were inseparable, you know?
I think honestly, that is the mark of a brilliant friendship. When you have a first moment like that, it's either going to be spectacular or horrible. And you know, I think we've stood the test of time.
Yeah,
definitely.
So, you know, now one thing I think me and you had in common, is, I could just speak for myself and then you could just say yes or no. I was a shit in the rear with the gear soldier. I sucked at being in the rear to being, you know, having the uniforms done, blah, blah, blah. But if you get me out in the field, get me hopping tanks, I can hop tanks 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And me and you, we formed a team, driver loader team, that we just hopped from tank to tank to tank and never slept.
Yes.
But you put us in garrison and everything goes to shit when we
get yes.
So am I the only one that felt that?
No. And I think honestly, that's the mark of a great troop. Just like there's all different types of smarts and there's all different types of people, there's all different types of troops. And, you know, there's definitely the guys that have got their airborne boots with the tips mirror polished and, you know, their ribbon rack is completely square and level and plumb. And, you know, you get them on a range and they're not so hot, you know, and then you got guys that look like they just rolled out of a duffel bag, but they can get things done. And personally, you know, as far as my crew goes, I would rather have four of them.
You know, and like I was talking to an NFL great, I was just talking to him today, you know, that sometimes when you have a team, you can either give me, you know, 15 prima donnas or give me five dogs. And I want the dogs and I want the guys that are going to, you know, go for every last inch. And you were the best loader ever. Hands down. I raise my hands to you. You were the almighty. And I think that's what made us such a great team that, you know, people would just take us as a team and go from tank to tank to tank to tank. So now, you know, you get into South Carolina, you get into the National Guard. And you know, I remember there was times that you crashed at the house so you didn't have to drive or sleep mm-hmm. in your car. So what was that like, you know, having to drive down and sometimes sleep in your car? Just because some people don't realize how hard the National Guard is on a person's life, because it's not full time, but it's not part time. It's a very crazy mixture. And sometimes it creates havoc on your personal life. So what was your life like?
I mean, I couldn't agree with that statement more. It is a full-time commitment to a part-time job. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, especially in today's climate, we see it every day. You know, you're no longer just a National Guardsman. You could get called up at a moment's notice and you're expected to have your shit in order and be deployed within, you know, 30 to 60 days. You know, you're going to all your affairs. Here's your plane ticket. Good luck. God bless. You know, support our troops. See you later. And it definitely plays havoc on the personal life. I can remember the very first time. I mean, as I mentioned before, you know, growing up in Rockingham, I mean, whatever is going to come there. So, for instance, you know, with the year we went to NTC, you know, that was the first time that Metallica ever played in Rockingham. My favorite band was playing in my hometown and I was at NTC. you know, and not only that too, but I mean, when you're getting ready to go for your 2 week, 3 week, 4 week, whatever annual training is that year, you know, there's the prep time. You know, you got to do your PCCs, your PCIs, your pre-combat checks, pre-combat inspections. You got to make sure your gear is serviceable. You got to make sure, you know, everything is tip-top, ready to go. And it's hard for employers to understand that. And it's hard for even personal relationships to understand that, because everybody sees the advertisement about, you know, part-time, serve your country part-time, you get full-time benefits. And, you know, and then you go to tell your boss, you know, hey, man, I need 4 weeks off because we're going to do gunnery at Knox this year. And they say, well, the commercial says 2 weeks a year. So what's the other 2 weeks for? And you're like, well, I mean, that's just what the orders say. And, you know, and then you get a problem with your job. You can. A lot of employers support and do what they can to work with you. But then, you know, there's a lot of employers that, you know, you're just another number. And the minute, you know, you can't show up for work because you got a 3-day drill and you can't come to work on Friday. You're gone.
You know, a lot of times then you'll have a back-to-back drill. So,
Yep.
But then usually, like, if there's a wedding, it's going to fall on that drill weekend.
Oh, yeah. Always.
And, you know, back then I knew you were in a relationship and you had a couple dogs. And I know that was rocky and that was hard on you. You went through a lot of stuff with that relationship. And then trying to deal with this military crap. So 2003, we get deployed. Where did you go?
Good old relaxing Jackson.
And we were up there together. And I think that's where I made my bones. You know, I think that,
right.
You know, they sent me to Bravo Company, which, it, you know, it's kind of like every time you hear Tom Brady, you know, he always talks about being picked 199th. You know, that's this is what pisses me off, that I know I got traded to Bravo Company because they knew I was going to be a shitbag and I was probably going to get chaptered out. And actually flourished over there under Sergeant Major Cheatham. You know,
exactly.
And so, okay, so what was it like up in Jackson? We'll just go over that for a second, then we'll get back to being deployed a second time to Afghanistan. What was your first deployment, you know, stateside deployment like?
You know, it was not at all what I expected. If you remember back then, it was in September of 2003, we got the warning order that Operation Palmetto Squirrel was about to kick off, and we had no knowledge of where we were going or what we were going to do, other than we had 2 weeks to report to the Armory, to then report to Fort Stewart, to mobilize to wherever we were going to go. You know, we went through an intensive train up, you know, ECP, access control points, you know, and it's September and I'm thinking we got to be going overseas, you know, OEF-3 is coming up. That's us, you know, we're getting ready to go to the big show. then literally, like 2 days before we go, they say, okay, well, you know, you guys are going to Jackson, you guys are going to Stewart, you guys are going to, you know, Gordon, have fun. And
a lot of people, if people are listening to this that are not military, and I try not to curse on here. I try to be a good Christian man, but sometimes it just comes out because it's warranted. But when you're 20, 22 years old and you're signing your life away and having your parents or somebody become your power of attorney, that's a serious mind fuck. That's when you're like, okay, this shit just got real. And the pucker factor hits really hard because, you know, even though we knew we're maybe just going to Jackson, we always sat around that TV thinking, okay, where are we going next? Because this can't be it. You know, we knew we were going for something else. So what was it like when you got up to Jackson?
Another mind fuck. Honestly, you know, it was, I'm glad you brought up Sergeant Major Cheatham. That was my first time I ever encountered him. I would love to talk more about him later. He's my hero so many ways, but, you know, it is complicated, you know, when you train and you prepare and, you know, you get your mindset straight that you're about to get in something and you get that, you know, preparing to go to war mentality, and then you're released on the general public CONUS. It's quite a letdown. You know, I thought that was going to be our one ticket to the big show. You know, the motto is never surrendered, but it seemed like we never deployed. And I was really disappointed. I remember Grenier and I sitting in his room in 2003 when and we watched Third ID roll into Iraq in their tanks, and we drank a beer and cried, and we thought, you know, that's our war, and we just missed it.
Little did we know. Now, you know, because I have a traumatic brain injury, if I don't say something, I'm going to forget it. So I want to talk about Sergeant Major Cheatham, and that's back when he was Daryl Cheatham. And
that's right. E5 type.
He always said, "Oh, I am the standard." And that always
stuck right
with me. But the first time I ever met him, I'm sitting in my room, and I'm listening to NWA, and I'm singing all the lyrics and using the N-word, and he just looked at me. He's like, "I know you just didn't." I'm like, "It's just music, Sarge." And from that day on, you know, me and him always had a great relationship. And if I ever needed anything, he was one of the gentlemen. And like I said, he was from another company. The people that my own company, they didn't want me, but he took me under his wing and taught me what it was like to be an NCO.
Well, and to go a little deeper into that, because as to how he showed you, to illustrate the kind of person that he is, Daryl already had his war 91. He was in CAV in Desert Storm, got his combat patch, did the thing, got out. Went to go work for the post office. You know, I really don't want to tell somebody else's story, but it's so amazing. You know, 9/11 happens. He re-enlists in the Guard because it's what he believes in and it's what he wants to do. And I remember when I first met him having the same kind of similar reaction, not knowing really how to take him. But I soon realized that, you know, he wasn't just blowing smoke. You know, he was the standard. If you wanted to be the man, you got to beat the man. And he was the man. PT, tactics, gunnery, it didn't matter. You couldn't mess with him. He knew it. And he was only an E5 at the time. But, you know, I mean, he ended up a command sergeant major. I mean, that's all you need to say. Right there.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, he made a big, and I don't even realize that the people that, you know, I told Shep before he passed, you know, how much he meant to me. And I don't think I've ever talked Sergeant Major Cheatham about this, but I think he was one of the ones that actually made me become the NCO that I tried to be. And when I did become an NCO, and I definitely tried to live that NCO creed. So what was it like, you know, coming back off I think we did 18 months or something. What was that like coming back off and then having to fit back into civilian life again?
Well, you know, it was another difficulty because you know, after my particular tour, I could only take 12 months and then I volunteered to go home. I couldn't take it anymore. you know, you're trying to do a job and you're constantly being messed with. Your supervisor's in the woods smoking a cigarette, making sure you're searching cars, you know,
and you know that he's going to be listening to this because he's a friend of mine on Facebook. So just you know.
Well, wait, no. Before, let me make the correction. I am not referring to our commander, Captain McDaniel, at the time.
Oh, okay.
Who was a great man and a brilliant American, and I love him to death. I'm actually referring to the infamous Major Reardon.
Oh my God.
The night stalker who would climb the fence at the ammo supply point just to sneak up behind you and try to catch you sleeping.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now you just brought it back big memories. Wow.
So, I mean, and that's it, you know, after 12 months of dealing with somebody like that, I was done. And especially because, you know, the main drawback with the Guard is that a lot of people, their only experience with active duty is what they saw in the movie. And so they tend to make when your deployment's more difficult than they need to be. You know, they have a very idealized Hollywood outlook of what we're supposed to do. And it's not, it doesn't really mesh with the actual active duty ethos. And that actually causes its own problems. And 12 months of that, and I was done. And
I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
I'll be like, we'll talk about the first deployment, then we'll talk about the second one. But, you know, we're all hua hua, you know, we're all manly, you know, but we get kind of coddled because we get paid on the 1st and the 15th. You know, we're getting TRICARE, we're getting BAH, BAQ, you know, we're getting 30 days paid leave vacation. And like my friend Sergeant First Class Nick Valentine says, once you step off the base, military does not give a shit about you. And you have to figure out, all right, what do I do now? Because now you get back from deployment, there's no job. If you have a relationship, it's probably fractured. So how did you go about transitioning back into the civilian life and trying to figure out, all right, what does Brendan do next?
Well, I mean, to be 100% completely honest with you, that was a question that I continued to ask myself until only just recently. And in 2003, I still didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I had a few menial jobs, you know, and I started going back to school. And because basically after we were deployed to Jackson, then I could no longer be considered a dependent for tax purposes, and I could apply, use the FAFSA without my parents' tax info.
Like when we came back, I noticed, you know, because like I said, we were deployed to three different places. And when we came back, like before we left, we were like, we were a gang. You know, everybody in that unit was like, it was like a gang. It was all for one and one for all. And then when we came back, it was like three separate factions.
Yes.
And, you know, and now you're looking at who's trying to get ahead, who's trying to cover their own ass. And you're like, all right, I don't fit. I, you know, like people know me, like when I first, you know, I was always that guy that we were going to have a good time no matter what, no matter what detail, we're always going to laugh. We're always going to joke and have fun, you know, and there were people like Sergeant Shepard that were that way, where, you know, no matter what we were doing together, he would make it fun. And it seemed like when we got back, it was three separate factions, and all of a sudden it became them versus us. Was I the only one that felt that?
No, not at all. I definitely agreed with that. And especially the way that they did split the companies up, so that when we did come back together as a quote unit, you know, we still were, oh, those are the Gordon guys. That's the Jackson guys. Oh, that's the Stewart guys. It took a while for us to kind of to mesh back in. And I think a lot of that had to do, honestly, with, you know, the way things were handled while we were on active duty. You know, there were some problems in the leadership, and, you know, that definitely caused rifts down the line, I think. You know, and especially when you get into comparing, like, say, living conditions at the different posts, or like, you know, your commander or your shift, and it's like, oh, those guys had it easy, or, you know, and it does. It has a tendency to fracture everything, and they really should have kept us integrated. I mean, we were already a company, and we're going to three places, and there's three companies. You know, we already have routines. We already have, you know, relationships established. Keep them together. But yeah, there was definitely a big rift when we got back.
So when was your next deployment?
The next deployment came up in 2006, and we got the warning order while we were at Knox during the filming of AT the movie.
I haven't thought about that until I looked. So I was talking to somebody. It was funny. It's like, you know, here I am, a ninth grade dropout. You know, I get thrown out of the military once. And here I am, like yesterday, I'm talking to Colonel Fivecoats. And he was the one that was in charge of all airborne and Ranger battalion or brigades. And I'm like, wait a minute. This same guy that was, you know, getting kicked out and gets traded because they know he's a piece of shit is actually sitting talking to Navy SEAL commanders and all these kind of people. And that's when I started thinking, well, I remember doing that ironing thing. I'm like, and now my kids are, you know, I got two adult. I mean, well, one is 16 and one's 18. I can't wait to show them that to see, to, you know, the Army wasn't all just all, you know, hoo-hoo-hoo. Sometimes we were really stupid.
You know? Well, exactly. And that was the exact point that I was going for in making that little documentary. It started off as just, you know, hey, let me get some cool HUA videos of like tank gunnery, and I'll tape my camera on the turret, and you know, I'll tape it up in the turret and try to get some loading shots, you know. And then as you know, things unfolded as they always do at annual training, and the silliness began, I realized then, you know, hey, I've got a camera. Why not show all of our family back home what is going on? Because they have no understanding. They have no reference as to what it's like. You know, yeah, we do gunnery 24-hour operations for a week, but we're gone for two. You know, that other week is so full of shenanigans and malarkey that I was like, you know, let's document this.
Okay. Now I have a question to ask, and I didn't think I was going to ask this because you said you have if you have copies, right?
Yes.
Was there any way that people may be able to order it, and maybe if they pay a little money to be able to donate that money to a charity of your choosing?
You know, I had not even thought about that, but you know, that would be an outstanding idea. I still have all of the files, and I've actually, you know, I had a problem when I've initially made it with the rendering, and I had some thoughts, you know, a couple months ago about maybe digging out the old files and seeing if I couldn't remaster it and get some of the kinks out.
I'm just throwing it out there, you know, so maybe we can let people know what we're talking about, but also maybe able to raise some money for some good charity, you know, for some something good that can come about it, you know.
I think that's a brilliant idea. I'm 100% down.
Okay.
We'll work on that. Cool. Offline.
So now it's 2006. We get the warning order. What happens?
That's when things got real. You know, honestly, I was going to, my ETS was up November 2011, and after September I realized I had to re-enlist. I had to. It was my duty. And after Knox, when we got the warning order, I had to sign another extension to go, and I had zero pause to do so. I really felt it was my calling, something I'd trained my whole life to do, and I felt I was ready, and that I wanted to test myself in the ultimate first person shooter. And on the other hand, I had also just kind of made peace with the world, reconciled my childhood, and found myself in a good emotional place for the first time in my whole life, was feeling love for everyone around me. And then I now have to go to war and potentially kill people. So there was a lot of mixed emotions at the time.
Now, did they put you in a certain squad and everything beforehand or for the train up?
They certainly did. When they called us out, they ended up having I think it was a Muta 5, a 3-day Friday, Saturday, Sunday drill at McCready. And they called us out and had us form up our own formation in front of everybody. And they said, okay, these are your platoons. And this is who you're going to war with. And when they did that, they did the exact same thing that they did in 2003, which is each platoon consisted of a mix of all three companies and very few people. There was no platoon that was wholly one company. And on top of that, and I'll say this, it's not PC, and people might hate me for saying it, but I mean, it was a joke within our platoon that we were the equal opportunity platoon. Kind of like the same feelings you had about being moved to Bravo Company. You know, there's five platoons of the Sec 4 company, and all of the platoons, four of the platoons were primarily white, and there's a few dark green troops in there. Third platoon, we were all dark green. They took all the people that were squad leader and above, or team leader and above, that were dark green, and said, hey, we're going to make a platoon out of you guys. And whereas every other platoon was mostly light green with a sprinkling of nice darkness, we were very dark.
And you know, well, one thing, I guess now you're bringing me back, you know, I remember standing in that formation, and you know, I volunteered three times and they kept kicking me back, and I'm watching the people that they're picking. I'm like, I know they're not picking that guy over me. I know that, I know I'm so much better of a soldier and a leader than he is. And it, I think my heart broke that day when we had to go home and realize, you know, especially you know, you were going over there and I wasn't going to have your six. That, you know, that was more important to me than anything, is just, you know, to remember that I can't be there to have your six. And that really, you know, that broke me down. And I went through a lot of stuff after that. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to let you know that, you know, that, you know, that's how I felt about you, that I always wanted to have your six no matter what.
Well, you know, and I feel 100% the same way. And I know that if, you know, if they had called your name out and we'd ended up in the same platoon, you know, it would have been a jolly deployment. But, you know, at the same time, when you start playing the what if game, you know, you never know what could have happened, you know, and you got to trust. That's one of those things that you really got to trust God's plan, that, you know, maybe you weren't supposed to go there so that you can be here to do this, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the other thing that really needs to be mentioned here is that your denial, and I'm not totally 100% clear on all the facts there, but I seem to remember there being a diabetic coma involved.
Yeah. I actually went into a diabetic coma at one point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I bring that up just to clarify that it's not like, you know, there was a lack of will on your part. You had issues that were not conducive to an austere deployment environment.
Yeah.
You can't regulate your sugar in the field, you know, in that field.
Yeah.
When you're gone for 3 weeks at a time eating nothing but MREs, you know, something happens, what's going to happen? You know, and that is not your fault. And I never held that. I never held anything against anybody who wasn't picked. I did have some reservations about some people who were picked and then decided not to go. But you know, that's their truth. That's their life. That's something they have to live with. I knew I couldn't do that.
Well, I got in a verbal altercation with somebody. I don't remember who it was, but it doesn't matter. And I was like, what do you mean you got picked and you didn't, you decided not to go? You know, those are our guys.
Mm-hmm.
Those are people that have slept at our houses. Those are the people that we've been in their weddings and in some of their divorces. You know what I mean? Those are the guys that, you know, we bled and we sweat, and you decide that you don't want to go. You'd rather take a rear detachment job in the rear.
Exactly. And I think more than anything, and you know, we saw some of that in 2003, because like I said, nobody knew where they were going. So when we got called up, there was a lot of people that suddenly had an excuse why they couldn't go. And then when it turned out, oh, well, they're just going to stateside. Well, oh, no, wait, no, I can do that. Yeah, I'll do that. You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, on this one, it was, you know, well, I'm not going to go. It's like, that's when you really find out who your brothers are.
So what was the train up like? And then what was it when you first hit boots on ground?
Well,
because what I think, you know, because this app will only allow us to do an hour at a time. So I think if we hit the hour mark, we'll just hang up and then we'll do a part two.
That'll work.
I mean,
that'll
work. The time today.
Always. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I just want to make sure that, because I want your full story to be told.
And that's, you know, that's awesome. Right. Yeah.
So now tell us about train up.
So train up, we were sent to Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And again, we were called up in September. And we all met up at the Marion Armory. And that's where we deployed from and reported to Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And, you know, right away, I could tell that we were going to have some problems there. And just quick illustration, I would say probably 80% of our classes began with the phrase, "All right, guys, so when you get to Iraq," and, you know, I'd look around. And everyone else is just kind of like, what the fuck? And, you know, me, I'm the guy. I raise my hand. And, yes, you, specialist. Sarge, quick question. We're actually not going to Iraq. We're going to Afghanistan. You know? And they would just kind of throw up their hands and be like, well, you know, man, I don't have anything for you. I've never been to Afghanistan, but I'll tell you what. Go ahead and sign my sign-in sheet. I'll leave the slides up. Y'all can click through them if you want to, but y'all have a good day. I'm done. And that was literally probably 80% of our classroom training.
And unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, you know that you're going into the shit. You know, it's not like we're going back on the gates again. You know, this is going to be real world. This is going to be, you know, 7.62 whizzing by your head, literally, if not other things. And they're just treating this like it's a game.
Exactly. And, you know, I will say that our senior leadership did some really good things. You know, they were very sure to make sure we got a lot of trigger time. They made sure we always had plenty of ammo. They made sure that we were familiarized with our weapon systems. And they did the best they could within the constraints of the environment that we were in.
No, I remember like when you were on my tank and, you know, you were my loader, you were the master with the 50 cal. If I had, you always had that thing running beautifully. So what was your weapon when you got chose? What were you carrying? What was your weapon of choice?
Well, initially during training, I guess I kind of skipped a first kind of big step in the whole thing too, in mentioning that, you know, when we mobilize as an armor battalion or a combined arms battalion, movement enhanced brigade, whatever we were at the time, tank, we were tankers. And, you know, as a tank unit, we have our own assets. We've got our own transportation. We've got our own mechanics. And so when we mobilize, they're like, hey, you're going to Afghanistan. We don't have tanks in Afghanistan. So now you're all infantry. And they took everybody who was not already a 19 kilo or combat unless qualified, sent them to a 2-week infantry training course at Fort Jackson, I believe. And, you know, and then we got to Shelby and it was like, all right, infantry tactics are us. Something completely different than, you know, we'd even covered in the AT a few months prior. We were doing tank gunnery and they knew we were going to a country with no tanks. So to say that they weren't taking it seriously, I don't know if I can say that, but there was definitely some disconnects with reality, with the training. I don't feel that we were provided adequate training for the environment we were about to go into. But I do feel that because we had people with us like Sergeant Cheatham and Lieutenant Broadway, who happened to be my platoon leader and platoon sergeant, they definitely did the right thing and did the best they could. You know, Broadway would come into the barracks at night and start timing people like, hey, Mahaney, disassemble, reassemble, and function check your M4 right now. Go. And hit the stopwatch. You know?
Lieutenant Broadway, I love Gene Hindman, and I just remember the good times that we had down at Savannah. So I always respected, you know, Broadway. I thought he was a stand-up kind of guy. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. I second that 100%. Honestly, the best officer I ever served under. And when you put Sergeant Major Cheatham in the mix, I mean, that's a powerful combo right there. That's going to make sure that regardless of whatever else happens, my men are going to be taken care of and stuff is going to get done, you know, and you need that. That's the most important thing. And we were very fortunate to have that backbone. And even though we were the equal opportunity platoon, you know, we were discounted, you know, they were like, oh, look at those guys. But, you know, the joke's on them because we had some of the best leadership, you know?
Yeah. So then once the train up, you know, how long did you guys do the train up?
We reported in September and we left. We had terminal leave right before Christmas and we had 2 weeks where we could go home. And then once we returned from that 2 weeks, we had like another week or so to go and then we shipped out.
All right. I think this is going to be a perfect place to end this episode. We're going to do a part one and part two. So guys, yes, if you're listening to this, the next episode is going to get real deep. It's going to get real, real. And so definitely check out part two. And we're going to step where he actually steps off the plane into Afghanistan, and then we're gonna let you know how it actually felt and from a from a real soldier's perspective of going into battle. So, Brendan, thank you so much for everything you do. I can't wait for the next episode. And I think people are going to be they already have respect for you, but I think they're going to have so much more respect for you after we tell your story. All right, brother.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for just having me.
I'm going to send you the next request as soon as we hang off here.
Awesome. Sounds great. I'll be there.
Okay.